Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
Hello. In this week's podcast, we talk to Rafe Larson, the fourth of five authors shortlisted for this year's Guardian First Book Award. We pick out some of the best bits from this month's book club discussion with Booker Prize winner Kiran Desai. But first, the big publishing event of the week was the publication of an unfinished novel by one of the giants of 20th century literature. And if you don't know who it is, this reading by Dominic West should give you a few clues.
He told her stories about his sad life. He told her about his daughter, who was just like her, same age, 12. Same eyelashes, darker than the dark blue of the iris. Same hair, blondish, or rather palomino, and so silky. If he could be allowed to stroke it, or le fleurer des lèvres, like this. That's all. Thank you. Poor Daisy had been crushed to death by a backing lorry on a country road, shortcut home from school, through a muddy construction site. Abominable tragedy, her mother died of a broken heart. Mr. Hubert sat on Flora's bed and nodded his bald head, acknowledging all the offences of life, and wiped his eyes with a violet handkerchief which turned orange, a little parlour trick, when he stuffed it back into his heart pocket, and continued to nod as he tried to adjust his thick outsole to a pattern of the carpet. He looked now like a not-too-successful conjurer, paid to tell fairy tales to a sleepy child at bedtime. But he sat a little too close. Flora wore a nightgown with short sleeves copied from that of the Monglas de Sancerre girl, a very sweet and depraved schoolmate who taught her where to kick an enterprising gentleman. A week or so later, Flora happened to be laid up with a chest cold. The mercury went up to 38 degrees in the late afternoon, and she complained of a dull buzz in her temples. Mrs. Lynde cursed the old housemaid for buying asparagus instead of aspirin, and hurried to the pharmacy herself. Mr. Hubert had bought his pet a thoughtful present, a miniature chess set. She knew the moves. With tickly-looking little holes bored in the squares to admit and grip the red and white pieces. The pin-sized pawns penetrated easily, but the slightly larger noblemen had to be forced in with an enervating joggle.
Dominic West reading from The Original of Laura, a novel in fragments by the surely unmistakable Vladimir Nabokov, which was published this week by Penguin. Nabokov was determined that the manuscript should be destroyed after his death, but his son and translator Dmitri was equally determined that it deserved to survive. So last week, we invited the book's editor, Alexis Kirschbaum, into the studio to debate the pros and cons of publishing it with Sarah Crown, editor of The Guardian's books website. The Original of Laura is certainly beautifully designed, so I began by asking Sarah to describe it for us.
It's an absolutely beautiful volume. It's got a deep black cover, and inside, the way in which it's laid out is really interesting and striking. You have Nabokov always wrote on index cards before he transferred the book, his books into manuscript, and this book has been set out with the index cards at the top of the page, and then underneath them, the words on the index cards transcribed so that you can read it.
Alexis, you've kept all the spelling mistakes in. This is very much a scholar's edition, isn't it?
Well, we thought if we were going to reproduce the cards as they were, and there's actually so few words, it was really important to keep in everything to make it as accurate as possible. So,
you put a huge amount of welly into it. Very high production values.
Yes, yes.
Why did you decide to do that?
I think it dignifies the book. And we wanted it to sort of be a celebration of Nabokov and to show it a lot of attention and care. And I think by doing that, you're showing respect for what it is and you're allowing it to be read in a way that it was written.
Now, Sarah, can you tell us what the story is insofar as there is a story?
Yes, there are two strands to the story, two main strands. The first is the story of a husband and wife, a much older husband, a young and beautiful wife, Flora, whom the husband dotes upon, but who has many affairs and lots of sex with lots of different people. And then there's the story inside the story, which is that one of Flora's lovers writes a book about her, which he calls My Laura, and then gives to Flora's husband, this doctor, Philip Wilde, to read. And Wilde is sort of devastated, but internalises it all and begins this process of imagining himself dead from the toes up. To be fair, I think that makes it sound a lot more complete than it actually is, because that summary gives it a sense of completeness which actually isn't there when you read it.
Is there a lot of sex in it? We think of Nabokov as sex, don't we?
We do. No, I don't think, not really, nothing very explicit anyway. There's some sort of speculation, imaginings, but nothing
raunchy. It's very physical, though.
It is very, it's extremely physical, but I thought the physicality actually played out in his description, Wilde's description, the doctor's description of his own ageing body.
Yes, exactly.
And that's where the gaze is going, not so much onto the sex.
Disgust with his own body.
Yeah.
It's sort of like Swiftian revulsion of your own physical mortality.
The big question, does it justify the effort?
From a production sense, absolutely. It's a gorgeous object, would take pride of place on any shelf. As a way of venerating Nabokov, you could say there's certainly an argument for that. I think in terms of the text, in terms of the idea of it as a novel, it's on the front, it's called A Novel in Fragments. I think really I've got to say no. It's not a novel. It's not even a novel in fragments. I'd say it's possibly a short story in fragments or a novella. But I found it quite an upsetting experience reading it, actually. To me, it didn't feel that there was even the reaching, the striving for brilliance. It felt like notes and a death rattle. This, I don't think, does him justice at all.
Alexis, justify yourself.
Justify myself. Well, I find reading it, I think there are certain phrases and sentences that are breathtaking. And definitely Nabokov's voice is still there, and his playfulness and his sense of a character is there, I think. I also enjoy reading it in the fragmentary form because it's almost like you're close reading a poem. And I think it's quite rare to be able to read a novel so closely and to have so much focus on the style, which you have to do because the plot isn't there. And I just find it a very interesting way of reading, actually.
I agree that there were some lovely moments. One of my favourites was there's a section about halfway through when Nabokov is talking about the publication of the book within the book, My Laura, and he talks about its emergence into the world and its sort of climbing and descending up the ladder of the bestseller list. And that, I thought, was lovely and pure Nabokov, playful and funny, and making of something small and sort of silly something kind of great but also silly. And that was absolutely wonderful. But in terms of the style, I can see what you mean about it being an interesting reading experience to sit down with these index cards and to go through them. But I wouldn't like to compare it to close reading a poem, because, again, you're talking about the difference between completeness and incompleteness. And in the same way that you wouldn't read the fragments of a poem and expect to be able to respond to them in the way that you would a complete poem, I feel very strongly that you can't do that in this case either. And stylistically, I mean, even when you get down to things like sort of odd spellings and words missed out and things like that, it's so clearly not a finished version that it feels to me unjust to respond to it stylistically.
I didn't mean that it was like a poem. I just mean that it's very rare to read a novel that closely and to focus sentence by sentence, because that's how it's written.
But doesn't that make it an object rather than a novel?
I don't know how you would define the difference.
Well, I suppose what I'm suggesting is that I guess you call it a novel in fragments, so then perhaps that answers my question. But your response is to the idea of Nabokov writing the book rather than perhaps to the book itself, and to the cards with his thumbprint rather than to the writing, maybe.
Well, I think we've been very honest about that. I don't think we've ever tried to make this a novel, and it isn't your average novel, but that's the whole point. It's not supposed to be an average novel. It's something different.
Yeah, I was very interested in his use of words. Very odd words. How in control of his words do you think he was by this stage?
Well,
there are obviously misspellings, but then there's also a vocabulary that's completely unfamiliar.
Well, he always always liked to use unfamiliar vocabulary, and that was one thing he did. And I don't know if it was because English was his second language. I don't think that was why, actually. He wrote English better than anyone could. Mm. No one can say how heavily medicated he was at this point or how ill he was.
Mm. Sarah, can you just tell us about some of the good bits? Because you and I were talking earlier, and there is some really lovely writing in it, isn't there?
Yeah.
Read me, for example, as you said, largely concerned with the disintegration of the body. Read us a little bit of that.
Yes, there's the quote that both you and I, Claire, really loved was this bit when the doctor, Philip Wilder, is talking about his sort of disintegrating body, and he describes it in this paragraph: I loathe my body, that trunk full of bowels which I have to carry around, and everything connected with it, the wrong food, heartburn, constipation's leaden load, or else indigestion with a first instalment of hot filth pouring out of me in a public toilet.
It's like Ulysses, isn't it?
Amazing.
Like, it's like James Joyce.
Yeah,
it's
very
Ulysses.
It really James is Joyce. Very Joycean.
There's quite a lot of description of nubile young bodies, isn't there, which is again very very.
And I think that must have occurred to him more than it usually did, because his was disintegrating and his was failing him. So he always had sort of an aesthetic or artistic interest in beauty, obviously, and in the beauty of young girls. But it must have occurred to him even more forcefully as his was giving out.
Sarah, do you feel that here the morality is queasy because he is let down? You see a lecherous old male imagination.
It didn't strike me as much as it might have done, because actually I think sex is quite downplayed here. Although there are these descriptions of beautiful young women, it didn't feel awful. Whereas, you know, perhaps it has done elsewhere. It's a very difficult one to navigate, I think, with Nabokov.
So the last and the biggest question, perhaps, is, do you think, Sarah, that Dmitri had the right to countermand his father's wishes? His father wanted this to be burned.
It's an interesting question, and actually I'm not completely sure of my answer, because I think when you boil it down to morals, well, then, yeah, I think he did, probably. We wouldn't have had the Aeneid if Virgil's wishes to have it burnt hadn't been countermanded. We wouldn't have had much of Kafka.
Mark Twain
wanted all of his literary effects to be burnt after his death. However, I think that there is a separate question, which is an aesthetic question, which is one which you should judge it on quality. And on those grounds, I think he didn't have the right to publish, because, God, who am I to say what Nabokov would have wanted had he been alive? But I feel let down by it, I think. And I think that's not the feeling that you should come away from it with. And perhaps that's because my expectations of it have been sort of heated up in a different way. But, yeah, I'd say on those grounds, no.
Alexis, of course you'll say yes.
Well, I think it's tricky. I mean, I think it must have been incredibly difficult for Dmitri to make this decision. And I don't think people say he did it for money. I think that's ridiculous. I mean, he's extremely unwell. He doesn't have long. He's not going to spend it. And he had to make a choice between his father, the father, and his father, the artist. And I think if he made the choice for his father, the artist, part of him made it for the public, because he saw that his father belongs to the public as much as he belongs to Dmitri. And I think in many ways that's quite noble.
Alexis Kirschbaum and Sarah Crown on Nabokov's The Original of Laura, which is published by Penguin and is available at guardian.co.uk/bookshop. Nabokov was famously an entomologist as well as a novelist, who has a blue butterfly named after him, Lysiades Melissa Samuelis Nabokov, to give it its full name. His influence is everywhere, and so it's perhaps not entirely coincidental that entomology also plays a part in the novel we're featuring this week from the shortlist of the Guardian First Book Award. It is the selected works of T.S. Spivitt by Rafe Larson. Its eponymous protagonist is a 12-year-old map-making prodigy whose scientist mother has dedicated her whole career to the pursuit of a rare, possibly even mythical, beetle. Several species of insects feature in the marginalia of Larson's books, which he designed and illustrated himself. And I happen to know that Eric Carle, author of the children's classic The Very Hungry Caterpillar, is a huge fan. There's inside info for you. But there's more to the selected works of T.S. Spivitt than beetles, and Ed Pilkington tracked Rafe Larson down to New York and asked him to explain where the idea for the book came from.
I knew I wanted to write about the American West. I knew I wanted to write about cowboys, but I wanted to kind of come in through the back door from the point of view of a son of a cowboy. But even T.S., the protagonist, didn't start out how he was. He was originally 50 years old and drunk and in Paris, narrating the book from a Parisian prison. So I wrote about 10 or 15 pages of this, and I said, this is total crap. You know, it's like, this is like Annie Prue on Quaaludes or something. So I scrapped that and finally realized he's 12 years old, and he's still on the ranch. And the kind of central tension of the book is that he's in direct conflict with his father, who's this classic, intuitive, laconic cowboy. And T.S. is this very hyper-analytical kid who can't understand the world without diagramming it kind of obsessively.
So they say first novels are always autobiographical. He is of Finnish extraction, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Is that I just spotted that detail. Are you of Finnish extraction?
I'm Norwegian, so...
Right, you know, we're in the same ballpark.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. I know a lot of people who write kind of thinly veiled autobiographical fiction, but... For me, I've never been able to write something that comes too close to the reality. As soon as I start rubbing up against my own world, I figure, oh, I'm going to get it wrong. So I have to turn the wheel a couple notches off. You know, obviously T.S. and I have shared certain experiences, and I love maps and so forth. But it was important to locate him in some place that I'm an East Coast boy. You know, I grew up in Boston. I live in New York. So. In some ways, I feel like this book could have only been written by an East Coaster who is kind of looking on the outside into a ranch in Montana.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, the two obvious sorts, Montana. The other obvious sort you've already mentioned, maps and cartography, which, for anyone who hasn't seen the book, the thing that leaps out of you instantly is that it's extra wide format with lots of sketches and maps. To go along with the writing that tell part of the story as you go along, almost in note form. So, you know, it's a very simplistic thought as you're reading it. I wondered whether you yourself as a kid was obsessive about that sort of thing.
Not to the degree of T.S. I mean, I think I have this fantasy of having my bedroom filled with this Akashic record of the world, you know, floor-to-ceiling notebooks of your kind of, you know, entire library of existence. But like most kids, I was a little bit too lazy for that. I mean, I did have certain degrees of obsessiveness like T.S. Like when I was in fifth grade, I wrote like an 18-page animal research report on the army ant. You know, so I'm the type of person who really gets into something and kind of explores it and unpacks it and, you know, gets really dirty around something. So I like writing about characters who have this kind of obsessive quality because there are other characters in the book who have that. But I think I'm more of a recorder of that kind of particular.
Right, so again, you needed a bit of distance between you and your character, but then why did you pick on cartography and map drawing as a... Is it like a character in itself in the book, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, that's one thing that I've always been interested in maps, and I always thought I was kind of a strange kid because I would stare for hours at our outdated National Geographic Atlas, just kind of, you know, just looking at these pages of very distant places where, you know, I've never been and probably will never go, and I think in this book I'm exploring, you know, how do maps tell stories? What is left off the page in a map or beyond the borders of the map, and what is left off the page in a novel?
I mean, technically you did the first sketches and then you got a professional artist to do the top copy of these drawings that are in the book. Is that right?
No, I did all the drawings, but when the book sold to Penguin US, I was paired with a wonderful graphic designer, Ben Gibson, who took my images and kind of roughened them up and put some sepia in them and gave them a much more hand-drawn feel.
Okay, but it was manipulation of your own drawings.
Yeah, yeah. He did a couple, like he did the map of Moby Dick at the end, which is this kind of extraordinary 8-page spread. Originally, I was going to hire someone to do the illustrations, but I found that I would probably, you know, get in a fight with this person because it's like thousands of requests that I would have. And I remember taking the leap that first, I did that first sparrow drawing and on the first page, and I had almost written a kind of complete draft of the book before I really started in earnest on the images. But I'm so glad that I did, because even though I'm not a trained illustrator, there was something about really inhabiting T.S.'s process of drawing that made me get inside this character in a way that you could never just through text. I was inhabiting his his way of thinking, his way of processing. And for him, the maps are these real emotional documents. So that was.
So do you think that enriched your writing in his character? Because it's a first-person book. That enriched the writing as well.
Yeah, it was a really interesting, because I'd written a first draft of the book, and then I went back and started editing and creating images for it. This was the kind of simultaneous thing. And the inclusion of images begins to tell a sort of side narrative, a corresponding dual narrative, where I found myself, I would include an image, for instance, of the dinner table conversations before and after Leighton dies, and then I would suddenly cut out a huge chunk of text because the diagram or the map or the image was doing the work of that narrative and doing it much more elegantly, simply leaving much unstated. So that was a wonderful kind of tango that I found myself doing between the text and the images.
You mentioned lighting on a 12-year-old as your first-person main character. Tell us a little bit more about why you, in the end, do you think you've found yourself in this voice?
Yeah, I mean, I've always been interested in children because I've taught a lot and been around children and been fascinated with their habits of mind. Kids still see the world for how it is. They ask these incredibly strange questions because they're looking, you know. And particularly kids that possess certain extraordinary abilities, in T.S.'s case, you know, the ability to spatialize the world on the page. I'm interested in the reaction that adults have to these quote-unquote extraordinary kids. Because I wouldn't call T.S. a prodigy or a genius because in many ways he's very much 12. He's emotionally, he's struggling with grief and, you know, the death of his brother and how he fits into the world of adults around him and his parents. So he's very much 12 in many respects. He just happens to have this incredible gift, you know. And so, you know, people ask me, is this a book for children? Is this a book for adults? I mean, I think there's no easy answer. But this book is as much about how adults react to the children in our lives as a child growing up. So there's a lot of kind of tales about adulthood in this that as much as about children as well.
And finally, what next? Can you say anything about what you're doing now?
Yeah, I've embarked on the next project, and it's completely different than T.S. Spivet. It's much more international. It's kind of an international thriller about this underground troupe of puppeteers that performs surrealist shows about particle physics for populations under siege. So there's some science in there. There's a lot of stuff about old technologies, radios and telegraphs, and the protagonist is from the meadowlands of New Jersey, another kind of swamp-like place. I'm drawn to these places like Butte, Montana, where people kind of fly over or drive through as quickly as possible because I want to know, like, what goes on there? Who lives there? You know, I like landfills and toxic places.
And any drawings in the next book?
I don't think so. I mean, I'm a traditionalist in that I need to find out what the story is first and then figure out, okay, given my toolbox, how do I tell the story? So I need to figure out the story a little bit more, but I'm not going to just certainly throw in images. You know, maybe there'll be puppet strings or something. I don't know.
Rafe Larson with Ed Pilkington. And we'll speak to the final Guardian First Book Prize nominee, Eleanor Catton, next week. This week in the Guardian Saturday Review, Zadie Smith explains how she warded off an attack of novel nausea by turning to the essay. There's also the next instalment of John Mullen's book club, in which he discusses readers' responses to Kieran Desai's novel The Inheritance of Loss. John spoke to Kieran at our book club event here at The Guardian earlier this month, and the conversation's available to download as a podcast now. Check our website if it hasn't automatically downloaded to your MP3 player. Here are a few highlights from that evening.
When you started it, did you think of it as a structurally ambitious novel, or did that seem a natural thing to do, or did you sit down with a kind of diagram of it?
No, I had no confidence at all. And it was written out of a supreme lack of confidence, this book. And I was very unhappy during all the 8 years, and happily unhappy for all the 8 years it took to write it. But the structure was not a strong decision made at the beginning out of being sure of myself. It came out of the story itself. and realizing that all these bits and pieces and struggling, really, it was the last thing that fell into place. And I realized the story itself had forced the structure. I am not a novelist who can decide on a plot, and I'm extremely envious of novelists who write like that, of people who make a whole plan, you know, who can write it up on their wall, chapter one, chapter two, or like Nabokov, all their note cards, and then they shuffle them, and when the note cards are in place, then they can begin on their novel. Or I remember going to Oxford, Mississippi, and looking at, oh gosh, what is his name? Faulkner's plan, and it was all there written on his wall. One, two, three, four, this, that, this, that. This book, I think, I just wrote in every direction. One character leading to another, one episode to another, realizing I should go back in time, reading old memoirs, getting new ideas, writing about my experience of New York. And then I had, I think, 1,500 pages. This huge mess, was really scared, and had to force myself to read through it all, make connections, see, oh, there's a link here, there's a bridge here, there's a pattern here. And maybe it, in the end, was a sort of attempt to make an aesthetic pattern. I hope that my third book, next book, will be different. But I find I'm doing the same thing. Yeah. Same thing. And I've heard other novelists have told me you're the only one I know who does this.
Kieran Desai with John Mullen for the Guardian Book Club. And if the recording of the evening isn't already on your MP3 player, you can find it at guardian.co.uk/bookclub. That's it for today's podcast. Thanks to my guests Alexis Kirschbaum, Sarah Crown, Rafe Larson and Ed Pilkington. I'm Claire Armistead. The producer was Scott Corley. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.